I'm so happy to welcome everyone to JTS tonight for what we hope is the first really of many conversations and events around prayer. If you're here, it's because you understand that communal prayer is full of blessings and full of challenges. So you know the blessings, that's what brought you here, and the challenges range from all the variation that we each bring into the room as individuals when we come into a communal prayer space, the challenges that are inherent to each community and its particular characteristics, the challenges of not understanding liturgy, the challenges of when you do understand the liturgy, and overall, this task of how to continuously renew an incredibly ancient template, ancient experience, an ancient tradition that we feel connected to, and yet can easily go wrong, go flat, or kind of not live up to what we want it to be or what we need spiritually. So that's the conversation we're here to have tonight. I'm so pleased that we have such great people here to have it with. Rabbi Dan Erbach was ordained here at JTS in 2003. And we're so pleased that she's recently returned to JTS and joined our faculty and our staff as Director of Liturgical Arts, which is a new position here, and that's really kind of making a statement about the value that that JTS wants to place on paying attention to this need. Jan is the Associate Editor of Sidur Lev Shalem, which is the new Sidur, long-awaited new Sidur of the Rabbinical Assembly, coming out this fall. And she was, before that, on the editorial committee of Machzor Lev Shalem that I expect many of you have already seen and benefited from. And she's also the founding rabbi of the Conservative Synagogue of Hampton, in Bridgehampton. Rabbi Eli Confer was also ordained here at JTS in 2007 and recently received his DHL in liturgy here. Is that right? DHL? Eli is the co-founder and executive director of Machon Hadar and a co-founder of Kehilat Hadar as well. He's the author of Empowered Judaism, What Independent Minyanim Can Teach Us About Building Vibrant Jewish Communities. And they are for sale and signature after the program. And we were all in rabbinical school together, so that's a nice treat. Wow. All different years we overlapped, and I believe that we even did a tefillah workshop together with Rabbi Kehilat. So I'm pleased to be part of this conversation. And I wanted to try something a little different tonight before we hear from Jan and Ellie, which is to try to distinguish this slightly from sort of your typical lecture, panel, discussion kind of program, in recognition that we're here to talk about a very spiritual pursuit. So if you'll indulge and go along with me, what I wanted to do was sing a nigun and kind of reach into the prayer space parts of ourselves and bring that here into the room and convert this lovely Kripke 406 lecture hall into a little bit of a prayer space and a space that's conducive to thinking spiritually about the words that we'll hear in a minute. The words for this melody, which we'll just sing on 999, I'm sure some of you know, O Lord, prepare me to be a sanctuary. Is that known to some of you? And I thought it was fitting for us because that's kind of what the pursuit of, what this challenge of perfecting and honing communal prayer is about, kind of creating wherever we go a dwelling place for God and for spirituality in our midst. Ya-na-na-na-na-na. Ya na 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 na. Ya 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 na 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 na. Ya na 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 na. Yeah.
I want to open by saying that we hear a lot these days about how difficult prayer is in our time, and you know, synagogue affiliation rates are declining, and we think of this as a new problem. I don't think it's a new problem. Prayer has always been a problem. It's been a problem since Abel's offering was accepted and Cain's was not. Right, and someone walked away satisfied from an experience of serving God, and someone walked away very unhappy. And I wanted to share with you, I want to open by sharing with you a comment that we are putting into the new Siddur. This is going to go next to, in the Amidah, we're putting it in Mincha, next to a prayer about praying that our prayer be acceptable, and also it involves the restoration of the temple. And this is the note that we're putting in. It is not unusual to experience our religious life as inadequate. We may see our prayer life as uninspiring or fruitless, not affecting our inner lives or our external world. Our ritual observance may not transport us in any way. In Jewish theology, these feelings are encapsulated in the idea that we are in exile, that somehow we are deprived of an intimacy with the divine that was available when the temple was standing. The assertion that there was once a perfect time is, of course, mythic. When the temple stood, the prophets railed against the false worship that took place there. In Second Temple times, the office of high priest was frequently bought and sold. Today, too, many religious institutions may be corrupt, more interested in their own survival than in the care of their members or their ethical legacy. But despite this, we maintain the dream of someday getting it right, of our religious life being a pathway to making our lives and the world reflect the divine good. That dream that our lives and our society may embody authentic service to the divine is implicit in our prayer for restoration. I wanted to share that with you because I think it encapsulates some of what many of us feel about our prayer lives. We have this dream that it's going to be so inspiring, and sometimes it's not. And it's not a new problem. It's always been a problem. Prayer is hard. At the same time, I do think that there are certain ways in which prayer is especially challenging in our time because in many ways, it is increasingly countercultural. There is a greater and greater distance, I think, between the prevailing norms of the society in which we live and the ways of being, our ways of being and thinking, our mindset, and the ways of being that prayer, and especially Jewish communal prayer, demands. And it's therefore, I think, particularly important, communal prayer, and even essential. For all of the reasons that it's countercultural, those are the reasons it's especially important. And so I'm going to speak primarily about challenges because the flip side of those challenges are precisely, I think, the blessings. And for my opening remarks, I want to use as a frame, there's a wonderful book by Ronald Grimes, who studies ritual from an anthropological, sociological perspective. And he has a book called Ritual Criticism, in which, there's an essay in there in which he talked about a study of Catholic worship renewal from 1963 to 1988. And I just want to say, when we say ritual criticism, it doesn't mean making a ritual of criticism, right? It means being a critical ritual. And that's a little bit of a joke, but it's actually the first thing I want to highlight as an issue. is that we are a culture that is highly critical. We approach almost everything we do in a mode of criticism, and we walk into a space thinking, already evaluating, is this good, is this not good, is this impressive, is it not, what do I think of this? And that already is a barrier to prayer. Right, that's already a problem. But I'm bringing his book because in the course of the interviews that were conducted about this particular study in the Catholic context, three verbatims that were gathered jumped out of me. They could have been said by Yogi Berra. They're a little bit funny, but they also, I think, encapsulate the problem, and here they are. We kind of have to do this because if we don't, we're not. It, meaning the service, is highly familiar and easily ignored. And then, everyone never does everything together. Okay, so those are the quotes, and I'm going to take them in reverse order. The first is that everyone never does anything together. We are a highly individualistic people and culture, right? And Jewish prayer is largely communal. We are all about self-expression and self-esteem. And Judaism comes and gives us a fixed text and asks for humility, a certain degree of submission, compromise for the sake of the community, what we would call tzimtzum, a little self-restraint and withdrawal. That's hard for us. And I want to say that, as I said, the things that are hardest for us are the things that are most important. There is a reason that we require a minyan, a prayer quorum, community, dafka specifically in, we say in Hebrew, devarim shebik dusha, matters of holiness. Right? Why matters of holiness? Lest we think, it's a technical category, but it speaks to a larger issue. And it speaks precisely, I think, to the culture today. Lest we think that it is possible to isolate ourselves and go off on a mountaintop and perfect ourselves and be in this wonderful, delightful spiritual space and think that we are aspiring to holiness, Judaism says no. You want to reach for holiness, you have to deal with other people. You have to deal with the people who are annoying. You have to deal with the people who interrupt just when you're getting into your own little prayer space. You have to deal with all the things that make communal prayer difficult. Because there's an integration between the vertical and the horizontal, right? Between our relationship with God and our relationship with other people. And prayer involves encountering others every bit as much as it involves deeply encountering God and ourselves. Right? So we're pushed out of our own little comfort zones when we pray, and that's hard, but it is, in a sense, part of the point. The second quote, right? The service is highly familiar and easily ignored. So we have, on the one hand, as Julia mentioned, we have the problem of literacy. Right? When the liturgy becomes too familiar and we run through it, we're not really paying attention, we don't maybe have real understanding, we're just mouthing the words, and we end up with prayer by rote, what Heschel called religious behaviorism. And the liturgy no longer serves to pull us up short, to make us catch our breath and be surprised and inspire wonder and awe. And then we have the problem of illiteracy on the other hand. Right? Inaccessibility, impenetrability, it's meaningless for a different reason. And here I think it's not just a problem of Hebrew literacy and understanding the liturgy. We've become largely illiterate about what it means to pray. And to some extent, about theology. We are, as a culture, obsessed with rationality, with using our intellect and understanding, with knowing. And we are far less comfortable and far less literate when it comes to mystery and ambiguity and that which lies beyond our power of explanation and can't be accessed with our heads. And if we add to that our increasingly shorter attention spans, right? And we tend to flip from one thing to another. We're used to an internet culture. We start reading something, even if it doesn't engage us in the first two sentences, we move on to something else. And our decreasing tolerance for process. We have another problem. One of the great misconceptions about prayer is that it should come easily, that it's a natural thing, right? We should, it's like breathing. You should naturally be able to pray. Well, I think it's not like that. We expect it to be immediately accessible, and it takes effort, and it takes time. And even in any given prayer service, those of us who lead prayer regularly constantly hear the complaint, the service is too long, why can't it be shorter? Right? And I'm reminded, Reb Zalman, Zalman Schachter Shalomi, points to a midrash that says that in the Isaiah verse that's quoted in the Kedushah, the Amidah, Kadosh, 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 Holy, 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 that the angels recite, that there's a midrash that says that it takes 2,000 years for the angels to say each one of those Kadosh. Right? So it takes 6,000 years to get to the level of holiness that we're striving for in the Kedushah. We come in, we spend 15 minutes. It's not meaningful, and we're bored, and we've had enough, right? And we give up. And we wonder why we don't feel anything. I want to say even the term meaningful, right? We talk now about meaningful prayer. I'm teaching a course now on creating meaningful prayer. Of course, prayer should never be meaningless. But the truth is, it should be more than meaningful. It should be more than meaningful. It should push us past our understanding, cause us to reach like great poetry and music and art. And if we can say exactly what it means, it's not deep enough.
It's what?
It's not deep enough. It's not profound enough. It should push us out of the familiar, make us a little strange to ourselves, problematize the parts of ourselves and our world that are highly familiar and easily ignored. And the last piece is we kind of have to do this because if we don't, we're not. Right? And this is a problem across denominational spectrums. Like, we have a problem with those who see prayer as obligatory, where it can become a burden and an obligation. And I would say when we see prayer as obligatory, sometimes we're not sensitive enough to what's really obligatory and what's not. And I fear very often that we lose the forest in the halachic trees. Right? That the core mitzvot of offering the heart, of accepting the yoke of the sovereignty of heaven, get lost in the mire of too much liturgy and too much technicality. Sometimes I think we have a Baroque cathedral that can't support the weight of all the gargoyles because the foundation isn't solid anymore. And then, of course, we have the problem of those who don't feel an obligation, who see prayer as primarily a kind of self-help thing, and who then we easily opt out the moment prayer stops being immediately rewarding. Deeper than that, many of us have lost the sense that if we don't pray, we're not. Not that we're not praying, but on some level, we're not fully human. We're not, in a very real sense. I think we've lost, in our culture, an intuitive sense of the way that prayer is an essential part of our humanity, our vitality, and the fullness of our being. We are uncomfortable with being vulnerable in that way to the need for prayer. I think we're uncomfortable with vulnerability generally. So what do we do? I'm going to hold most of that for the question and discussion. I'm going to very briefly three things. One, what we do is we don't run after fads. We have to remember that one size doesn't fit all. And that having a healthy prayer life is a complicated process and a lifelong work. Two, we need to educate and become educated not only about liturgy, but about prayer. And three, we need to think systemically. It's very easy to blame the people in the front who are leading the prayer and saying they're not inspiring me and they're not doing a good job. And I think we need to do a better job at educating our prayer leaders to create more, to create richer and deeper prayer experiences. And that's part of why I have this new position here. We're going to do that. But it's not only about the prayer leaders. What happens in an experience of prayer is affected by everybody in the room. And so all of us who come to a prayer experience have to think about, what am I bringing? What am I open to? What am I closed to? How am I contributing or not to making this a deep and rich experience of prayer? So I'm going to stop there.
Hello, I'm Ellie. I just wanted to, first of all, acknowledge that I'm sandwiched between two of the people in my own prayer history and journey who have facilitated very powerful prayer experiences for me, and it's an honor to be with both of you on this panel. Tell me if this sounds familiar, and we'll know if you, what Sidor you grew up with. In solemn testimony to that unbroken faith that links the generations,
one to another,
let all of them rise to magnify and sanctify. For those who didn't grow up with the old Silverman Sidor, the black Silverman Sidor, first published in the late 40s and then again in the 60s, this was the introduction to the Mourner's Kaddish. I've been doing some research into the English prayers that precede the Mourner's Kaddish as a way of framing what the Mourner's Kaddish is about. So as a part of that, I was looking at some old English Hebrew translated Sidurim and found the following. This is from the preface of one such Sidur. There is too much reason to fear that the appeal made by the liturgy of the synagogue elicits but a feeble response from the intellect and the emotions of the modern Jew. The aspect of our places of worship on Sabbath mornings tends to show that the service lacks those vital elements which are needed in order to ensure its sway over the mind and the heart. Even of those who regularly attend a synagogue may go away unimpressed without having experienced one prayerful feeling. But besides these, there are many others whose habitual absence from the house of God is plainly attributable to the failure of the service to perform its special function. This is from a Sidur that was published in 1890. So just to ratify Jan's point, this is not a new problem. And of course, the solution to all these problems, at least from the prayer book editor's perspective, is the new prayer book. which this prayer book, which none of you have ever heard of or seen, clearly didn't solve. What I want to sort of offer, maybe as just a way of echoing some of the ways that Jan framed the problem, is what, in my opinion, is the sense personally, and perhaps others share this as well, is that we both know too much and too little about prayer. When I say that we know too much about prayer, what I mean is we think we know what we're doing and what we're saying. And we know it, and therefore we object to it. Like, I know that I don't like X, you know? I know that I can't stand Y. I know that I know that because I think I know what it is. And you can pick your own, if you're talking about the words of the liturgy, what's your own pet peeve liturgical line? What's the one that you say, oh, I can't wait till they cut that out of the new Sidur, or I've got to grit my teeth and say it until they do. I think that part of the prayer experience really is actually not about knowing what we say, but about experiencing the flow of the words. I was thinking actually about the Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. I just said that 6,000 years faster than any angel could. Feeling pretty good about that. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh is obviously a quote from Isaiah, one of the very few quotes in Tanakh of three words in a row. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Maybe you can count on one hand the number of times in Tanakh a word or a phrase appears repetitively three times. So what is the function of saying holy, holy, holy? Are you trying to transmit some information? And if you didn't hear it the first time, I'm going to say it again, I'm going to say it again. Or is there some non-cognitive experience that's born of repetition when you say Kadosh, 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 you are actually being angelic because you've skirted your cognitive ability to understand what you're trying to communicate from an information perspective? Right? The Kedusha is not more powerful when I have a deeper understanding of the word holy. But really, it's more powerful when the mantra side of when you repeat something actually becomes what prayer is about. I think that's also related to part of Kaddish or Kol Nidre. When you say Yitbarach, Yishtabach, Yitbar, Yitramam, Yitnaseh, Yitadar, Yitaleh, I challenge you, we were talking about this in our liturgy class earlier this week, I challenge you to describe the difference between each of those verbs. What does it mean for God to be, you know, and you look at the translations, I don't know how you did it in the New Siddur, it's like, you're trying to get at this, I'm trying to tell you what it is, eight different ways that God is holy, that God is blessed. But the function of that is really, in fact, to get you to, in my opinion, to get you to a non-cognitive space where you're not thinking about the meaning of the words anymore, where you're actually just letting the words wash over you. And the fact that we don't speak in America Hebrew as our vernacular, and luckily for the Kaddish, very few people speak Aramaic as their vernacular, that's okay to identify with the sounds of the words. Like if you cut the Kaddish, or if you translate it, they tried this in the old Reform Siddurim, they tried to translate Kol Nidre into German. Didn't fly. People don't like it. Because it's not the words that sound with a certain beat and all end A, that experience of what it means to hear the words of liturgy. So on one hand, we know too much about what we pray. And on the other hand, I would argue we know too little about what we pray. That is to say, we think we know what the words mean, but language itself is a very unstable and imperfect system and vessel to communicate any sense of meaning. And by that I mean just sort of understanding. The Mishnah Berurah, in his, he has a couple of comments where he advises against translating the prayers. Even though the Mishnah itself, Mishnah Berurah, like 20th century, Mishnah, 2nd century. So the Mishnah says that you can essentially recite almost all prayers in the vernacular. In the Shema, the Amida, Birkat HaMazon, you can say them in translation. And it was only until very recently in Jewish history that there was an opposition, sort of coordinated opposition to translating prayer. Now, part of it, you know, from my aesthetic perspective, is if you translate Kol Nidre, you sort of miss the point. But Mishnah Berurah says, we can't translate the prayers because we actually do not know how to translate the words. And he brings the example of Totafot, that we all know from the Shema, right? L'tatafot b'neinecha, frontlet. This, I'm going to put this in the category of words that have been translated into English that nobody knows what they mean. Like, ask your friendly non-Jewish neighbor what a frontlet is, or a phylactery, or a tabernacle, or you get the point. So what when you translate totafot, in the Mishnah Berurah's opinion, you actually haven't done anything. But I would go more than that, which is to say that even if you take out the ambiguous words, the field of understanding of what the words are referring to is actually deeper than any singular meaning that you could come up with in the first place. I'll give you one example of that is, let's use this, Magen Avraham. Blessed are you, God, Baruch Ata Hashem, Magen Avraham, Shield of Abraham. Now, there's a lot of questions you can ask about that line from a cognitive standpoint. First of all, where were Isaac and Jacob? I just saw them. They were there in the second line of the Amidah. And now they're gone by the end of this bracha. And where are the matriarchs? Where's everybody? It's only Abraham, right? But I would also ask, what does it mean for God to be a shield of Abraham? Why not God as a lover of Abraham, or a partner of Abraham, or a creator of Abraham, or any number of words that you... Why shield? What does shield mean? And what do you... When you hear the word shield of Abraham, and you focus on shield, what do you visualize? What do you see? Is it sort of like the Mel Gibson arrows flying into that humongous shield? Is that what it is? Interesting, the word magen actually only comes three times in Torah, the root, magen. It's a very rare word. It comes from the same word as in Hebrew as gan, like gan eden, a garden. Because a garden is something that is protected, that is shielded, it's hedged off, literally. Magen, gan. So when you translate the word into shield, you don't get the garden aspect. But more importantly, what you don't get is the fact that almost all liturgy quotes the Bible. So even if you know what shield of Abraham literally means, unless you understand that it is drawing from a section of Torah where God says, Al tira Avram, anochi magen lach, schercha harbe ma'od. Don't fear, Avram, I am a shield for you. Your reward will be very great, which is the beginning of Genesis 15. This is the last line that God says to Abraham before Abraham opens for the very first time to talk to God. Abraham's very first words to God are, Mati tainli, what can you give me? Because I don't have a child, Avram goes on to say. And the only one who's going to inherit all my stuff is this random guy, Damesek Eliezer. Right? Where's my child? Okay? And later on in that same chapter, God promises Avram the land. And Avram responds by saying, Bamai daki rashena, by what will I know? Ma, again, what? How shall I know I'm going to get the land? Now, when I say Magen Avraham, I'm saying Shield of Abraham. I'm saying a word that has something to do with garden, which is a softer image. But I'm also recalling the moment in the Bible right before Avraham opened up with a whole host of complaints and doubts. Right? Right before Avraham actually speaks to God and says, Ma, and says what? So if you understand Baruch Ata Hashem Magen Avraham as a quote of Tanakh, that then allows you, stepping into the shoes of that dialogue, to then open up with your ma, with your what's your unfulfilled promise, then the experience of saying the words, blessed are you God, shield of Abraham, becomes something different. And so, we don't know enough about the words that we say of prayer. So I'm trying to argue both ends of this, which is to say, we know too much. We don't allow the words, we're not comfortable, this is the rational side of us, we're not comfortable with the irrational side of prayer that's trying to take us on a sound journey. And we also don't know enough about the words, because even when we can translate them to transmit information, we're missing the field of meaning that's really there to unlock and uncover. So at the end of the day, where I end up is in a stance of humility around the liturgy, where I feel like there's a lot to be done there, and it's up to us to figure out how to unlock those pathways to start experiencing the liturgy in a deeper and more meaningful way.
I can't resist saying about, in solemn testimony to that unbroken faith, when I grew up at Congregation Caliph Israel in Brookline, Massachusetts, and we had this amazing orator of a rabbi, Manuel Saltzman. He would say that every Shabbat, and there I was with my dad, and he would say, which links the generations one to another, and I always, as a child, thought he was saying, which schlinks the generation one to another, and I wondered for many years what that meant. Okay, thank you so much to both of you, and I neglected to mention when I introduced Ellie before that Ellie is also teaching here this semester, liturgy, of course, for rabbinical students or everyone. Okay, so I was picking up on some of the things that both of you said. I was reminded when you were talking, Dan, Abby Pogrubin wrote a piece that a lot of people read. It was not this past year, but the year before, I think, before the High Holidays. So sort of a big complaint about the epic failure of High Holiday services. And in that piece, she kind of laid the blame equally at the feet of the clergy and of the congregants. So both of you are engaged professionally in teaching the leaders, which is a whole project unto itself. And But then there's the other, there's the piece of the rest of the people in the room, which is most of the people. And my question is, what is the responsibility of those people to make the prayer experience work and to modify that? Like, what can you realistically expect of people? So people, we're beyond the era when prayer was expected to be a routine part of everyone's life. We're beyond the era when we have all those biblical texts and associations or most of us are, at our fingertips. We don't have that kind of flow of the text embedded in us. And we haven't taken the time to sort of reflect deeply on what prayer means. So just your typical American person today coming to Shul who kind of genuinely longs for a prayerful experience but doesn't have all of this wherewithal, what can you kind of realistically expect of such a person? And I guess another way of putting that is sort of how optimistic can we be with our realities about the possibility of transforming communal prayer into something that moves us somewhere and reaches deep inside us.
You want to start? Or you want?
Please.
Okay. So, from a practical perspective, I am actually pretty convinced that the greatest barrier is not the liturgy, and it's not our relationship to the liturgy. And I'm also convinced that we can't start by asking people to invest an enormous amount of time and effort to either start with the Aleph Bet and learn Hebrew, or to deepen their understanding of Hebrew and spend a tremendous amount of time probing the meaning of the liturgy. I just don't think that's realistic. What I do think will make a big difference is if we begin to speak in the language of what it really means to show up and be open to prayer. I was doing some consulting with a synagogue that had put together a committee to start thinking about their service and what they were going to do. And after spending a little time together, they said, could you leave us with a question that we could think about that would help us? And I said, sure. I said, the question I would ask you to think about, and this was a group of lay people who were working with their clergy, is how can you become the person that the person next to you will feel safe being vulnerable with? And there was this kind of silence. I mean, I really think they wanted a very different kind of question. Right? And I think that's really very much at the heart of prayer. And it involves asking our congregants and asking all of us to come to a prayer experience with a willingness to be open, with a willingness not to engage, as I said, in ritual criticism, but to allow oneself to be moved. And to recognize that sometimes we are using the opacity of the liturgy as an excuse. It's not meaningful, and I don't understand it, it doesn't make sense to me, and therefore I don't have to come. When the reality is very often, I don't know that I'm really willing to allow myself to be affected and changed. It's frightening to really pray. Heschel talks about prayer as an invitation to God to intervene in our lives. It's pretty scary stuff. And I think if we can move the conversation to that level and begin at that point. In a sense, it's the harder work than learning the liturgy, but it's also the more immediately rewarding work. It's what yields the real fruit. I'll share with you one of my favorite commentaries. We have, you know, many of us are familiar with the standard blessing formula that begins Baruch Atah, right? And it begins, I know many of us know this, in the second person, addressed directly to God, right? In Hebrew, we call that nigle, second person. Literally, it means revealed. And then it always shifts, nearly almost, to the third person. Who does? Asher kiddushanu, Asher, right? Hamariv aravim, who brings the evening, something in the third person in Hebrew, nistar. And it's very common to we say, why do we do that? Why change the grammar in the middle? It makes no sense. The most common explanation that is given is because God is both immanent and transcendent. God is very close. You can address God directly. God is revealed in a certain sense. And God is distant and hidden and far away and inaccessible. But the Abudraham, 14th century commentator, he brings that. And then he goes on, he says, but the real reason is not because God is revealed and hidden, but because we are. Because we come in saying, I want to connect, I want to reach you. And the moment we sense something real, we say, oh, I'm running away, turning my face, and now I'm speaking to God in the third person as though there's no real presence there. Right? And that's the problem. We abscond. We hide ourselves. We run away. And so I think really that's the place to start. I think that's what we need to start having this kind of conversation. That this is not easy. It's not emotionally easy. It's hard stuff. It's scary. But if we want it to be meaningful, we have to be willing to go there. And it's about everyone in the room. The most skilled prayer leader in the world cannot open someone who walks in like this. And I faced some congregations like that, right? If we're unwilling to be moved, it doesn't matter how beautiful the service is, it doesn't matter how gorgeous the liturgy is, and it doesn't matter even how much we understand about the liturgy. If we're not open, nothing will happen.
Again, just probably to echo in other words, I would say there's two practical things that I would recommend. One is, I think, and this I speak to myself when I say these. When I grew up, I only went to one service. That's what I knew. And for me, going to shul meant going to this service. And that's why I can recite to you by heart the introduction to the Mordecai's Kaddish. I think when I started to go to other places of worship, I was, by not all of them, but some of them, actually was jolted. That experience that you talked about was sort of jolted in a way that I understood that there were other potential options of what it meant to connect in prayer. And I think that for me, it's like you need a new drug. It's like it used to be you could go to Shirat Harashah. I was like, wow. Now it's like I spent 2 years ago at Sefer Rosh Hashanah with the Karliner Hasidim, who screamed the entire davening. That's different, right? They stand for all of Rosh Hashanah. Also, it takes them 7 hours. So next time someone complains, unless you've been standing for 7 hours and screaming on Rosh Hashanah morning, I don't want to hear it, right? But seeing something that's very different from what I know opens my eyes to what prayer could be like, and so I try to do that as often as I can, which cuts against this idea, which I'm challenged by, about praying with people that you know and people that you're in community with, and that itself has its own power. But I feel like to only do that, to never step outside yourself, and to go to a place you would never, I'm not joining the Karliner sect, but, to see something that's outside is very powerful. And the other thing, this is to combat what Heschel calls religious bashfulness, which I have in spades, and I think is again one of the cultural norms is to be bashful in religious spaces. Here's an easy way to test how bashful you are in religious moments. Do you sit in the front or in the back? I guarantee you, no matter how crowded it was, you will get a seat in the front. There's always room in the front. And for me, two experiences that I had around this. One was going to the Karlbach Shul. This is already years ago, so I don't know how it is now. When I would go, I used to go in the back because I would get there on time, which meant I was late, and there was no room, and I would just, stay in the back. And then one time, my brother was up at the front, and he was sort of beating along on the Amud, and so he invited me he told me, come up and stand next to me, and lo and behold, there was a seat next to him. And I'll tell you, in the front, it was totally different. Totally. This is true also for me at BJ. Again, years ago, probably 20 years ago when I first moved to New York. You sit in the balcony, right? That's where you could get a seat, you have a little more room, right? But then one time, the balcony was full, whatever it was, they were like, go to the front. Sat in the front, totally different experience. So I think there is this opportunity to challenge ourselves and say, how am I going to make this different for me? As opposed to going and doing the same and expecting the same and indeed coming out with the same.
I have to just, on this notion of religious bashfulness, when I was in school here, I took a course on Heschel and Hasidic prayer with Rabbi Samuel Drasner, Alav HaShalom. And he taught us a nigun that in the middle of the nigun, you have to yell out, Oy vey! And he told us that he learned it from a rabbi whose name, unfortunately, is lost to me, who used to teach it on the first night of camp at Camp Ramah. And he would watch to see which of the kids could not bring themselves to say, Oy vey! Because he knew those were the ones he had to work on all summer. But it's precisely that. It's that embarrassment.
I want to pick up on that last point you made and also what you said earlier, Jan, about chasing after fads. So this is kind of a two-part question. So we do, because we're so in search of how can we make our service better and what works, we sort of look to what are the places out there that are having a better service where people seem to be happier and more spiritually engaged. And how can my shul be more like Ikar, more like Romamu, or more like Hadar, or more like BJ, or the Karabakh shul? And and yet, I think fads is a helpful word. It was helpful for me when I think about it. Right? Those are all 20th century kind of trends in how to make tefillah better. And you know, for the shul in Minneapolis or Birmingham or whatever, those things don't translate. I just remember for myself, you know, having, I don't know if anyone's davened at the Leader Minyan in if it's still called that.
Where?
At the Leader Minyan in Jerusalem.
It's still called that.
Hands down, the most profound prayer experience of my life happened at Kol Nidre at the Leader Minyan. The first time I was there, we sang the piyut at Kol Nidre Ki Neka Chomer about how completely and totally vulnerable we are in God's hands, and we got through the words, and then Eben Leader, who was leading, sang the nigun for a good, like, 20 minutes or so after we finished the words of that piyut, and I went into a space that I had never been, and certainly I had never been in a communal context. And there we all were crying out, and he achieved the kind of creating a safe space in which we could scream like that, and we really were. And about our complete fragility. So then I come to Hadar and I try to teach that melody and we put it on the Hadar CD and it's okay, you know. So we can explore and we can see great things that are happening out there that are really engaging people. How do you kind of modify that and bring that back in a genuine way to your own prayer experience? First of all, without kind of idealizing the trend and making that trend into the answer as opposed to the tool, but also in a way that's kind of genuine for where you are and where your community is. And I'll just tack on and add a challenge to that question, which is the difference in prayer experience, not just from one individual to the next, but if we think in terms of age. Right, so we... A lot of these great trend-setting things are happening in Minyanim, not all, but a lot, in Minyanim of young people who have nothing better to worry about. They don't have kids to go home to or stressful jobs or whatever. There are these sort of happy, angst-ridden students, you know, who have all the time in the world to pour into their prayer lives and innovate all kinds of great things or, you know, whatever, some version of that.
Not the stereotype.
Just not the stereotype. So... I think that's just an added challenge. You know, something can be the thing that works for that minion of 20-year-olds, or the family shul somewhere else, but the spiritual needs of a 70-year-old are completely different.
Right. Well, I think if there was an easy answer to that question, we all would have a different shul. For decades, people have been trying to import something to their local space that's going to change and be the new, whatever, the new Coke. I'm going to go back to what Jan said. If the people aren't on board with the project of vulnerability, there's very little window dressing that you can do. I think that'll stick. I mean, I think a non-fad is your emotional state in prayer. that's something that is very hard to work on. I also think that, like, realistically, there is something that's called a critical mass. You need to have a critical mass of people who are going to draw in the people who are on the outside or not ready for it yet. And if you start with everybody as diffuse or not on board with the project, you're not really going to get that far. Now, that's not to say that there's no value in communal prayer when people aren't really interested in the emotionally intense and vulnerable experience. There's a lot of celebration and communal markings that happen in those spaces. But if you're really trying to have the experience that you were just speaking about, a leader or that you've talked about, I think it's very hard unless you have a group of people who you can start with, like a cluster, that can make it happen, and people are willing to be driven by, and that's why, like, it's just harder to have these things in less populated and diverse Jewish areas. For me, on the question of age, I would say, like, and I feel like I learned this also at Karlbach. It's like the guys at Karlbach, again, this is like probably 15, 20 years ago, they were of multiple ages, and I don't know. They had like the energy that I had as a 20-something in my non-stressful, non-kid life, which seemed very stressful at the time. And I would say that I think that there's probably more that we have in common than that we don't have in common when it comes to the age difference in prayer. And for me, it gets to the question of yearning. Are you able to express a certain sense of yearning? And does that yearning transcend whatever particular life stage you're in? When you get a lot of people who are focused on the yearning aspect of being human, which I think is cross human, I think a lot of good can happen there.
So we disagree on very little. I've always been moved by there's a teaching of the Baal Shem Tov on the command, Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, right? You should love your neighbor as yourself. And he says, who is l'recha? Who is your neighbor? It's God. And what it means is that you have to love God as you. You can't love God as anybody else. Right? And that's true of individuals, it's true of communities. We do run after fads, and I think it's a little bit because there is a realization that in many synagogues, worship is dull, and it's not working, and we want to do something, and we look for something that's working, but there's a difference between adapting best practices and saying, I want to be like them. And I think a community has to really look at who they are as a community. Who is their leadership? What is their natural spirituality of the leadership? What can they do well? And not ask our rabbis and cantors to imitate people who they're not. And not ask a community to be somebody they're not. Not every community is going to want to put their arms around each other and sway. And right? I mean, that's not the culture of every place. And part of it is about recognizing that there are many, many different styles of deep, powerful, meaningful prayer. That, you know, a lot of congregational singing is one style. Meditative silence is a different style. Some people find it really meaningful to have very formal, more liturgy that's more filled with awe. There are communities for whom that's it. And not to judge oneself or others by comparison. So that's one thing. The second thing is I do think there are differences as we age. And I think, you know, when I was a kid, I played the violin very seriously, and I became a very, very good technician. But the truth is I had nothing to say. And now that I'm older, and I don't play anymore, and I don't have the technique, now I feel it's a while, it's a shame. I have something to say, and I can't do it anymore. To some extent, that's true in part of prayer. When I go to some minyanim that are very, very young, and it's very thrilling, and it's exciting, and it's so wonderful to see younger people engaged in prayer, and it gives me hope for the future. But for me, as a prayer experience, because it feels not quite deep enough. And sometimes there are very concrete things that are different when you're young. You know, we'll pause to, you know, to say the names of people in need of healing. Okay, we're done, right? Because at that age, most of us, thank God, most people are not so much dealing with serious illness. As we get older, issues of prayer become more pressing and deeper. And there's another factor also that comes in. We've been talking about this in my class this semester, and that has to do with gender. And as we age, many of us actually become more balanced in our genders. Women sort of take on a little bit more of some of the characteristics that are sometimes associated with masculinity, and men sometimes discover more their feminine side. And there's a richness that comes with that. And a nuance that emerges also in our spirituality as we become, in a sense, fuller human beings. And so I think we make a great mistake when we overly romanticize the what emerges as energy in these in very young minyanim and think we should all be like that. I actually think prayer is something we grow into, that can deepen as we age, and where we should be reaching out are to people who are baby boomers, who have raised the kids, who have achieved what they're going to achieve professionally, and now are ready to really move deeply into spirituality and have a little more time, and also feel the pressing need to meet their own spiritual needs and to reach out to something beyond them. I think there's tremendous richness there. And it's one of the reasons why I am a big fan of davening in multi-generational settings. Because I think we need to learn from each other. As we get older, we want to see the energy of youth. And it's good for youth to see the depth of age. We need each other.
So on that note, why don't we open it up?
Question, but it has to do with
the
prayers itself.
Can
you give an example, Elio?
Can you speak louder, please?
You gave an example before of the Kaddish, the preface to the Kaddish. But then I think about the High Holidays and how harsh the liturgy is. You know, the actual liturgy is in the High Holiday so that I can enjoy being, let's say, at services year-round, but it's harder on the High Holidays when the words are about who will live, who will die, and how do you deal with that issue around prayer?
Yeah, just to repeat the question, all well and good during the year, but what about on high holidays when there are some very, very difficult words that we say, specifically, who will live and who will die, in the Unatana Tokef prayer itself? Yeah, I think that prayer itself is a fascinating prayer worthy of analysis, because it is a long poem that introduces the Kedusha and has its own internal structure. Actually, but that doesn't necessarily soften the mi yichyeh mi yamut. But for me, I would say, I don't know. Everybody is alive and everybody's going to die. And I feel like part of the function of that particular phrase is reminding us about that scary and real fact. I mean, you can also couch it in the biblical understanding, like Adonai Mimitu Mechayeh is part of Hana's song, that she says upon having a child. So what does it mean to live and what does it mean to die in the context of God giving life to a descendant that you've been praying for, as opposed to who will live, that is say, will I live and will I die, or will my sick friend live and sick friend die, as opposed to does life continue, going forward? But I think part of the function of that, why we all sort of, I was going to ask you, well, what is it so harsh about? Is it, you know, is it Melech Elyon that gets you, is it Aleinu? But it's, okay, so Natan HaTokef, because there's a moment when all of a sudden we can just, like, it hits us in the gut, and we have to react. And sometimes I'm, like, okay with the fact that those reactions can be strong, because it's rare that someone gets you to move, even upset in davening.
I would say also, certainly we can always drash liturgy. Like, we can always find a way to read it in a nicer way. But I do think that part of the function of prayer is not only to comfort us and inspire us and make us feel better. Sometimes it's to make us uncomfortable. Sometimes it's to push us to confront things that are hard, that it's easy in life to ignore. And I think especially on the High Holy Days, we are asked to live with some really uncomfortable feelings and questions and realities and doubts and challenges, and we dwell with them. I will say, and it certainly is true that every editor of every prayer book thinks this is the book that's going to solve the problem. but having worked on the Machzor Lev Shalem, the feedback that we've gotten is that with respect to the High Holy Day liturgy, we really actually have helped people deal with it. Because we provided alternatives that both explain and argue with and allow us to express simultaneously what the liturgy is saying and our objection to it, and to hold that tension on the same page. And that's been what we've heard back, is that people find it enormously helpful to see their own struggles reflected on the page, not taking out the liturgy, but contextualizing it and sometimes just arguing with it.
I'm not so sure I know how to verbalize this. What I'm hearing from you, Jen, if you really, by the way, it's very touching. Thank you very much. Is that
we're great? Is what you said? Yes. And on to your question.
Is that we as prayerful people need to allow ourselves to be more vulnerable to our own spiritual needs and feel the intimacy and love with God, and that on the one hand feels like can be accomplished on a hilltop, which is what you said is not what it's about for us as a Jewish community, synagogues. So can you say something about where the communal part comes in?
Sure. Sure.
Because I think the relationships within the community drive some of this to vulnerability as well.
Right. So the question, to summarize briefly, is if we're talking about vulnerability and being present to ourselves and our relationship with God, how does that relate to being in community and the function of the community also in that vulnerability? So you're right. When we pray, we are we're functioning hopefully on multiple levels, right? Sometimes at once, sometimes over the course of a prayer life at different times, right? Or over the course of a service at different times. And the great challenge here, of course, is to be vulnerable in the presence of others, to not just know intellectually, but to really get and realize the sense in which our vulnerability and the sort of the embarrassment of our humanity is shared. And therefore we are approaching not only ourselves in this way, but others, and having the experience while we're seeking this spiritual experience that hopefully is rewarding, of also needing sometimes to bracket our own needs, to make space for another, to be present in a different way to somebody else's vulnerability in the room. And it's a balance. You know, sometimes we need to be praying in a way that's going to meet our own needs, because if we don't, we will run dry. But we cannot only be meeting the needs of the community. And sometimes we need to bracket our needs and show up and be present for a service that may not be exactly what we want, that we may not feel like going to, because the community needs us, because someone else needs us, or we need to tolerate things in the service that are not for us because they work for someone else. And that experience itself can be a spiritual deepening and an offering to God. There's a little bit of the mission. There's a piece of Mishnah on in Mishnah Bikurim about the bringing of the first fruits on Shavuot, right? And there's a little thing that you recite that most of us know from the Passover Haggadah, right? My father was a wandering Aramean, etc. And the Mishnah says that initially, people would bring, and the people who were literate would read this aloud. And the people who were illiterate, the priests, the Kohen, would read with them. What happened? People stopped coming. Because they were embarrassed. So the rabbis decided the priests are going to read along with everybody. So Rav Kook has this incredible reading of this. And he says, what's going on here? Can you imagine the sacrifice of the literate? Right? If you think about what the temple service was like, there was very little that you got to do. Imagine how it felt. And the ego issues aside, right? Sometimes we have ego issues, we like to show, look how much I know. But put that aside. Imagine how rewarding it must have felt to be able to do this one thing yourself. And what a loss when it was taken away. But for the interests of the community, because people stopped coming, the literate had to give way. And Rav Kook says that itself is the service. That's the prayer. That's your offering. And so sometimes when we're in community and there's an English reading and I don't like it because I like to daven in Hebrew, or this is a melody that doesn't work for me, but you know, this group life. So in that moment when it's not working for me, then I'm pushed to a deeper spiritual level to say, all right, how can I, in my disappointment or my frustration, offer that as prayer? That I'm here anyway, and I'm doing this for someone else, not for me. And that's where the community comes in to deepen the prayer experience, is to remember that my prayer is not only about me. It's about serving. And if I'm by myself, I can lose sight of that.
What happens if you don't have a new sitter, you don't have a new congregation, you don't have a new person sitting next to you, you know, new external circumstances that might be changing your life? How do you overcome or develop the spark in terms of the same old week after week after week?
Well, I'll take that one.
Singing.
Yeah. How do you renew yourself if there isn't a natural change that's happening in your already committed space of prayer? I don't know. It's a little bit. I think that I struggle with that sometimes, and I try to take it on to myself because I can at least control myself. I would say that like one of the things that I used to do in davening, that is sort of the intellectual version of coming in like this, is bringing a book, right? Shul is a place, thank God, no one's going to bother me. I'm going to get to read for 2.5 hours. Make it longer, right? You know, keep on going. You want to speak? Great. But I think that, like, your headspace, my headspace, when I read a book, by the way, I was reading holy books. I wasn't reading a comic book. But, like, the part of your brain that works on that is not the part of your brain that could ever access a prayer experience. And so what I was essentially doing was taking myself out of the game, even to begin with. Now, I'll say that more recently I've gotten a lot less reading done in shul, which has had other problems for my life. But I would say, like, for me, I'm trying to sacrifice of the literate, sacrifice the reading for maybe, and I'm being literal here, like 5 seconds of good davening. Like, if I could have 5 seconds of good davening in 2.5 hours, I think it was worth it for me not to read.
Wow.
And I think that that's something that I can control. Like, at least I'll be ready if it comes. Whereas if I'm reading, I'm not ready. And I'll just say one other thing about the communal space. I think that the community, for me, enhances this. I go to shul, an amazing shul in Washington Heights you should all come to, which is multi-generational and amazing Bali Tefillah. No one ever makes a mistake in the Torah reading. It's incredible.
What's the name of it?
I can't tell you because then you'll come. It's the Four Tryon Jewish Center, ftjc.org, a revitalized shul in Washington Heights. I think that part of what community is, you get, just like you think you know the liturgy, you think you know your community. At a different shul I was once, I adopted that for a number of years, they once had a communal meeting. And I was a newcomer at the time, but one of the old timers says, I don't even know everybody's here's name, and we never talk to each other at Kiddush, you know? It's like, you think you know your community, but actually we really don't know each other at all. And I think that's true, even if you do know everybody's name, you rarely know what other people think about the liturgy. You can assume that they all have a problem with the davening that you have a problem with. But it turns out, you know, David Wolpe made this mistake once, turns out that some people believe in the Messiah, you know, or want the temple to be rebuilt, right? You can't make an assumption about what everybody's problem with the prayer book is. That's part of what it means to be in community. And I think that part of what I might do is, like, sit down with my friend that I'm sitting next to every week for davening and say, hey, what part of the davening do you like the most? What part do you not like the most? Just to sort of try to mix it up with the people that you know.
I would also suggest, because this is a problem that everyone struggles with. You are not alone, and it's a difficult problem. I think we need to feel free sometimes to put down the book and focus on our own prayer and consciously ask the question, how am I different today? What's different about me now than yesterday? Or what do I want to be different? And sometimes I think you do need to bring a book that's gonna inspire you. Sometimes reading poetry or reading theology can inspire a feeling of prayer. And I think if, you know, if you're in a synagogue and it's not changing, then you have to be mindful of the way you are changing and bring that into prayer. But it's not easy. I don't mean that to sound flip. It's a very challenging thing.
Should we take a few and we can combine our sponsors?
Great idea. So let's hear a few questions at once. Okay.
So you haven't spoken sort of specifically or even so much generally about music. I think it's your title, by the way, is great. Director, I don't know if you came up with that title, but Director of Liturgical Arts.
My title.
Is a pretty cool thing. The reason I bring up music is I wonder, when you speak of sort of liturgy versus prayer, and I would throw one more word, which is experience, that I wonder if more what people are going for is the experience, and the liturgy is sort of the vessel that gets us there. But I think, you know, music is that piece that taps into that other side that lets people access.
Yes.
I'm a cantor, so I'm biased, but it seems like it's a big piece and a big part of who we are as worshipers. I don't know if I've ever been to a service of any denomination that had no singing,
right.
No chanting, no
right.
anything that accessed that musical piece.
Right.
So we'll hear a few questions at once.
My question is also about music. I'm a cantorial student, so we spent a lot of time talking about new stuff. And yesterday we had a great program with Juilliard where we talked a lot about the role of improvisation. Cantorial art, right, within Chazanu, and the intersections between jazz and this kind of improvisation. And I wonder, you know, everyone talks about the death of Nusach and Chazanu. I'm from the west side, I go to a lot of shuls, and mostly a lot of nigunim, and I've been to the great program with Joey Weisenberg and this whole fad about Nikumim, and which is great. And I just wonder, do you guys believe that there is, you know, are we running away from the words? Chazon Nu and Nusach at its best, you know, really paints the words, and it kind of is in a time. It's not metric, so you're a lot of, you know, people on their own chanting Nusach, or the Chazon chanting Nusach. It lives in a non-metric environment, whereas when you go to a shul, that's constantly congregational melody and yigunim. Often you get lost in the wash of music, and we don't actually interact in the moment with the word. So I wonder, have we gone too far with yigunim in particular?
Yeah, I just have a comment, and I have three little questions that will overlay to music, actually. I've been in the same synagogue for over 25 years, and my community, I see a lot outside that synagogue, in their homes, in their cars, in restaurants, whatever we do. And I know their gossip. I know their complaints. I've heard people say things I would never repeat. And so it takes a notch down from... In other words, I know them too well as secular people, and I know who doesn't like who. You understand that this is what communities are, actually. They're not all so glorious. And yet, so we transpose them to the synagogue on Saturday morning. It's not so easy, and they surround me. Now, I've been to synagogue, just to try it out, I've been to other synagogues on Saturday where no one knows me, and I don't know them, and I feel like a stranger. But I also feel there's sort of a relaxation. I don't have to deal with them, you know. Like, and so it's sort of a contradiction. And yet I felt, you know, I don't belong there because I was surrounded by a couple hundred people. No one knew who I was. The thing about vulnerability, you talked about it a few times, and I mean that has a lot of psychological context. But when I just retired, but when I worked every day, all week and nights. I came to synagogue really to gather strength. I had been vulnerable all week. I'd been chopped up, you know? And so I looked for something that would give me strength through the death of a parent, through a divorce, things like that. I was very vulnerable. So, I mean, you brought that up enough for me to wonder, like, is, you know, like, that's the last thing I want to be is vulnerable. I'm not worried about that. I know how to open up, and it's a matter of getting straight. Now, here's my three little questions. You mentioned, I'm sorry, this is Julia here. I heard also in your talk from 1890 the term prayerful experience. You both said it like everyone knows what it means. I'm not sure we all do. It sounds great. I can sort of guess what you mean by prayerful experience. I'd like to hear about that. The thing about music is a lot of people like myself who didn't grow up learning Hebrew, and we know the words to the prayers from the melodies. That's true of Broadway shows, rock and roll, the way all of us know words to songs, including prayers, are the melodies. Those same words on a page, if you took them and rearranged them, I would struggle through it. I'd get it. I'd plot away. But the melodies really give you a chance to bring the words along. And then here's the last thing I want to talk. It's also about music. You didn't mention instruments at all. And I want to know where that is or isn't part of Nu. I don't know if these 20s kids, that I use instruments? I don't know. I also thought about them. They haven't lost a parent. They haven't lost a child. They haven't been divorced. I'm wondering, was it like glorious to be 20s and praying? I don't know them. They're not in my synagogue. It's a conservative synagogue. And there's no one at all in their 20s in my synagogue. They're someplace else, but my kids in their 20s, they don't go to synagogue. They love being Jewish, but they sort of cater, whoever the word is, or appreciate their Judaism other ways than synagogue going.
I'm just going to pause you there because we only have a few minutes left. So I think most of these, we just only have a couple minutes, but everyone can stay and converse afterwards. Most of these questions, I think we're getting at music from various aspects, so maybe I'll invite you, and maybe I will too, talk about that a little bit in our last couple of minutes.
Yeah. So first of all, I think the people who have raised the issue of music being an essential element of prayer are 100% right. We didn't deal with it today, but obviously it's a huge piece of prayer for all kinds of reasons. One, because it speaks to a different level of our being than the music an ability to get directly into our kishkas and our emotions and our souls. And sometimes I think, we talked about this in class yesterday, sometimes the music is ancillary to the words, and the music is there to carry the words and make them sensible and make comprehensible. Other times it really is about the music. Really is about, in the way that you were talking about the sound of the words, in the same way it's about just about the sound of the melody that speaks to the soul. I personally think that we have actually gone a little too far away from some of the more formal music. I'm a big fan of congregational singing. I think it's huge. I think there is something theologically that we lose by not having moments when we are just listening. There's a sense of awe and a sense of being overwhelmed that is lost when it's all about participation by singing. And sometimes that can be a cover for a lack of inner participation. When we say participation, it's not just am I singing, it's is my being involved. And sometimes, not always, sometimes the congregational singing really brings the inner participation with it. Sometimes it masks a lack of inner participation and it becomes singing in community, shira b'tzibur, and not really prayer. I'm not advocating going back all the way to the other side and having a very frontal service with very little communal singing. But I think when we pick our moments carefully, having those moments of listening to really great singing that interprets the liturgy magnificently is important. I also personally think Chazanut will come back. It'll come back into fashion. Like right now, it's out of fashion. There will come a time when we'll have this romantic image of the old synagogue with the great chazan, and I'm hearing that a little bit, actually. It will come back.
Why don't we talk about that afterwards?
Yeah, when it does, we're going to let you know. Exactly. I would say, for me, that the question of music is really in a larger aesthetic field that I think we often think of it between like music or no music or instruments also. I wonder also the way in which, I know I'm going to lose this, by the way. Instruments are totally going to take over, but I think that instruments, relying on instruments to create the music, actually also allows us to seed what we need to give to make a prayer service to an external force that is doing it for us. Now, again, there's obviously a long history of music and prayer in temple times, but I think it's, I would proceed with caution. But I think on the question of music, I would add other aesthetic questions, which is, how do you dress in prayer? Like, are you wearing shoes or not? I'm just saying. Or what do you do with your body in prayer? Like, we all now have our hands hold the siddur, but what if your hands aren't holding the siddur and your hands are going like this in prayer, which is the old biblical model. Like, when Shlomo HaMelech dedicated the temple, he literally got down on his knees and held up his hands like this. That's a different way of experiencing prayer. Same thing with space. I mean, we have the space that we have, but what if we're all standing closer together versus farther away? Or lighting. You know, I was once in a Sudash Lishit where the lights went out on a timer, and all of a sudden it was totally dark. That is a different experience than where you can see everybody's face and you're looking at everybody. So I put music generally in the category of let's think about it and let's think about other aesthetic, tactile experiences that we could introduce into prayer as a way of just offering some variety into how we might experience prayer. And I'll just say one last thing from my perspective, which is we talked a lot about vulnerability. There are other strong emotions that I sort of associate with prayer. One of them comes from an old midrash, which says that you should say to the prayer leader, not bovid palel, come and pray, but rather bovid karev, come and karev, which then the Midrash goes on to identify as either do our battles, literally fight our wars, asay milchamotenu, from like, Karov both means to draw near, and a sacrifice is a korban, but it also means to fight, like hand-to-hand combat. You got close, right? So what would it mean to think about other strong emotions in prayer that also include, you know, some aspect of fighting?
Maybe I'll just add my answer to that question as we close. I think, and similar to what you just said, Ellie, I think, you know, the liturgy isn't the end any more than anything else, right? It's the end, the goal is prayer. And everything we think about that, what everything that entails, everything we're trying to accomplish that. The liturgy, I think of as a tool just as much as the music is, or just as much as our physical garb or the life experiences that we're bringing in, right? We have sort of a whole arsenal, to use war imagery, of things available to us to try to accomplish whatever our prayer goal is, being close to God, or however we define the goal of prayer. So I'm a lover of liturgy, but I think at the end of the day, it's a template and a springboard, and one of many tools to draw from to move us forward spiritually. I wanted to thank you so much. I feel, you know, as the beginning, kind of what's our job to make things better, and I think I feel like what you both shared has refocused me a little bit. I know the next time I'm davening in a communal setting, I'm going to be thinking, am I being the kind of person that the person next to me can be vulnerable next to? Am I succumbing to the, you know, to the rhythm and the flow in a way that that helps move me forward spiritually? So I hope that everyone here found something here to draw from, and that we can bring back to our communities and engage in this endless this endless project of praying together. Mr. Fox, thank you.